Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, and we link to our guests. We'll be giving you a website so that you can get more information about our guest today, and I'm very excited about the program as well. I think that you're going to enjoy this. This is sort of a dovetailing off of the 2014, no, I think it was 2015. I'm losing track because I've known this guy so long, and we've been talking so much about it that it starts to get diffused in the melees of everything else. Nonetheless, we did a series, 12-part series called Myth Sophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom. And this is sort of dovetailing off of that here on the program. As we talk with Dr. Reverend Karen Tate, she's an author, she's a teacher, speaker. She also hosts her own radio program. We'll find out more about that, as well as a social justice advocate. And we want to welcome our guest, Dr. Karen Tate, to the program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Richard. I'm so happy to be here with you.
You delve into an area that, on the one hand, is very intriguing to me, but at the same time, I kind of get the feeling that my side of the aisle. And then again, this is from a cursory perspective, and because I know more about this than that. But nonetheless, there would be some who say, oh, we're being left out on the other side of the aisle. And that is when you talk about some of these issues regarding, I don't know that I want to necessarily specifically say feminism, but women in goddess and spirituality, wisdom. You're all, you deal with women's issues, but from a mythological standpoint, but that also have a practical application for us today.
Absolutely.
And I would say that the criticisms, for example, that Tim Allen received in his bit regarding men are pigs and how he was being anti-women were so far from the truth, it was ridiculous. All he was saying was that sometimes guys, they need to spend time with guys. Women are in the same vein. It's the same way. But then also there's the argument that the patriarchal structure needs to go, or at least needs to be set aside for a time and let the matriarchal process unfold, as it did in my family growing up with four sisters and a mother, my brother and my father and I. We were in the minority, but I didn't mind that so much. And I seem to get along much better with women than I do a lot of men as well.
Well, you know, you've said a lot there. I'm going to try to remember all the points that jumped into my mind as you were speaking. But first, let me agree that, you know, I think when men and women only maybe listen to the soundbite, you know, when they only hear about the sacred feminine or they hear about feminism, they think it's mostly just for women. And in large part, it is for women, but it's also for men and it benefits men as well, you know, as I'm sure we'll get into. You know, the matriarchal, you know, I mean, I don't want to imply to your listeners either that I'm thinking, you know, women are always great and women, you know, always take the high road, because there's a lot of messed up women out there too. I think it is really a mindset. And some men have it and some women have it and some don't. You know, I mean, you look at Margaret Thatcher, for instance, you look at Sarah Palin. These are women that they may share, you know, they may be the same gender, but in no way is their mindset what we would call the feminine, the sacred feminine, you know, goddess oriented, sacred feminine liberation theology. Definitely not. But then you look at wonderful men like maybe former President Jimmy Carter, Father Roy Bourgeois, Charles Eisenstein, Noam Chomsky. You know, these are people that put forth ideas that do very easily fit under the umbrella of the feminine or feminism or the sacred feminine, if that makes sense.
It does indeed. And of course, another element too is that I think that it's a wonderful thing that we have women who have been diving into, in particular, politics, but of course, business and dealing with the whole glass ceiling issue, and whether it's also religion, the religious institutions, and trying to make their way up that particular clerical ladder, if you will. From a political standpoint, it has nothing to do with the woman's, with her being a woman. I'm just tired of hearing of the Clintons, the Bushes, all of these other people. I don't want to hear about them anymore. But at the same time, I wouldn't have a problem with, you know, a woman running the show for 4 or 8 years. Let's see what happens. What I mean, how much worse could a woman really make it? And who knows? She might make it better.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who would love the novelty of finally a woman in the White House, but it has to be the right woman.
True.
You know? Mm-hmm. I think it's got to be the right person in the White House. And quite frankly, you know, especially today when, you know, Bernie Sanders has just come out and endorsed Hillary Clinton, I think Bernie Sanders more represents the feminine than Hillary Clinton does. There's a perfect example.
I've been hearing interesting rumblings that come November 4th, I don't even know what date we're voting. But anyway, that first Tuesday in November, people are going to be really surprised at who may very well be the next president. And it may not be the top two that are out there now, which is saying an awful lot considering that, you know, they're supposedly the two individuals at the top right now, one and two, are the presumptive nominees. And, you know, they're going to just go head to head. And I think that's another element as well. And again, not to dive too much further into the political realm, I think people are also tired of the rhetoric. They're tired of the name calling. And I think this will sort of tie into another element. You were a part of a film, and I don't even know if I can pronounce this correctly. Is it just Femme or Femme?
No, it's Femme.
It is Femme.
Yeah, Femme Women Healing the World.
Yeah. And this was produced by Emmanuel Eater or Eiter?
Well, it's French, so it's ATA.
ATA, all right. And also Sharon Stone, who was involved in this. And I think that it goes to the element of the power of words. And I've never agreed with the argument that, look, the words are said and it's just politics. That's all it is. And I say, no. When you say something, if you don't mean it, you shouldn't be saying it. And if you say it, you must mean it. So how can we have any kind of a dialogue, whether it be on a political level, law enforcement and civilians with some of the issues we've been dealing with, clerical, educational, corporate and or business, or even just simple relations amongst ourselves, let alone between the sexes, if we aren't clear on what we really want to say, and that we're not doing more harm with some of what we're saying?
Well, you know, Richard, I think the problem is, you know, we've gotten to the point where people want everything in sound bites. And I mean, you look at Facebook, for instance. If you don't have a picture with a phrase, people won't even look at it and read it. You know, our attention span has gotten so short and so small that I think sometimes you have to say something and then clarify what you meant, because the words themselves might not necessarily get your full notion across. For instance, Femme, Women Healing the World. If someone heard that, I think they would think that we mean it's just going to be women who are going to heal the world, and nobody meant that. But, you know, you have to be willing to have the patience to delve a little bit deeper and maybe look at the film or read something about the film or learn about some of the people involved, like myself. You know, it goes back to, this is really a mindset. This is really a sort of an ideology. And this, while I will say that I think generally, And I'm you know, kind of speaking in broad terms here, generally women might be more predisposed to carry forward these ideas. They don't always. And it doesn't mean that men don't have the mindset to care about these things and push them forward. Because what we're talking about are values. You know, we're talking about, remember when greed used to be one of the seven deadly sins?
I remember from the movie with Michael Douglas, yes.
Exactly. You know, greed, you know, that idea coming back, you know, that we are our brother's keeper, that idea. The ideas of caring, sharing, negotiation, partnership, justice, equality, those are the values of the feminine. And I think when you, you know, when you take the time to start to break it down and hear what I'm saying, that you know this isn't just something for women, but because women have been rendered second-class citizens in patriarchal society, whether it be religion or politics or corporate America or academia, they tend to be the ones struggling for it, fighting for it, educating about it, because they have been the disenfranchised. You know, men have generally been the more privileged, especially white men, especially rich white men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so therein lies, I think, why you see more women pushing for this, because they've been disadvantaged the most. But men want these things too, because they're tired of the domination out there. I think they're tired of the polarizing politics. You know, they would like to really have a democracy again. You know, they would. They're tired of the income disparity. You know, they may be cared, believed what Jesus said, and, you know, maybe they're a progressive Christian and are disgusted by how far away, you know, some of the Christian values are compared to the things Jesus taught.
You know, and you bring up Jesus, I find it fascinating. This, and I've read the Bible many times, and I find it utterly incomprehensible. I cannot wrap my brain around this. That women have not played a more dominant role in the various Christian sects, including Catholicism, when you read the New Testament and you read the post-crucifixion story, the first person to see and recognize and know who Jesus was Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
And the men, when they came across him, So who are you? What are you doing around here? They didn't know who he was at first. And I sit here and I go, why? And then, of course, Mary Magdalene. She is put down. She's supposedly a prostitute. That's the general consensus anyway. And yet at the same time, she's the one who's nearly stoned. And yet, well, wait a minute. It takes two to tango here. What about the guys? They're right. Just as guilty, but nobody... You know,
well, you know, I know, you know, maybe some of your listeners are going to say, gee, she sounds like a conspiracy theorist. But, you know, that's the mythology that's been passed down to us. Yeah. And if that serves your agenda, well, you perpetuate that mythology. The reality is, if you take responsibility for your own education and you read about the early church and you read about early Christianity, it used to be the liberation theology of the day. Women flocked to it, slaves flocked to it, because it was more about equality. But then when Christianity left the home living rooms, where women had some control, and it went out into the public sphere, that's when things started to shift. It became a patriarchal thing. And you know what happens when you have a powerful woman, you know, that just can't be in patriarchy. You have to demonize her, you know, and that's why the goddesses have been demonized. That's why Mary Magdalene became a prostitute and was demonized. You know, Lilith was demonized in the Bible. You know, you have this over and over again in society where it, you know, it's a power grab. It's a gender struggle. I mean, I hate to say it, and that's what we've had, and so many people don't even understand it from this perspective. You know, they just believe what maybe they've heard from the pulpit or the dining room table, and they don't look beyond the rhetoric or the, you know, that, you know, that version of mythology. And that's really what it is. And, you know, when we get into this idea and we start to understand that mythology shapes our culture, you know, the stories we tell each other shapes our culture, can we not see it any more clearly than in Mary Magdalene's story or in the Garden of Eden story? You know, Mary Magdalene, we spent thousands of years talking about her as a prostitute. And when the church finally tried to fix that and, you know, say they made a mistake, how many people even know they've tried to fix it because it was done so quietly? You know, it's going to take a while for that idea to catch on, that this whole propaganda of her being this, you know, prostitute was not accurate. Or the Garden of Eden myth, for instance. I mean, look at the impact that Garden of Eden myth has had on humanity and still does. And feminist scholar Merlin Stone said she believes that was one of the first pieces of political propaganda perpetuated to demonize the feminine and escalate and you know, put forth the masculine as, you know, as the leader, the one that, you know, and subjugate women.
Yeah, I had a real problem with the story in general, just because of the fact that by virtue of what the two of them did, and they shared in the crime, if you will, that now, just by virtue of being born into this world, you now share this issue. And I was like, wait a minute, that makes absolutely no sense. That's like me walking into a room filled with bank robbers and suddenly, oh, I must be a bank robber. That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it just makes no logical sense. You know, this whole aspect of because we've talked on the program, the Mythosophia series, about a lot of different things surrounding mythology. But one of the things came to my mind was feminine heroes, if you will, or even the goddess archetypes and so forth. I think in terms especially of Hinduism and the various myriad goddesses that are not only recognized but acknowledged and given their due within Hinduism. And that women are just as much an integral part. However, you still have, in the material world, you still have this whole issue of the class system and so forth. In Christianity, it's the same thing. Women can't, you know, do certain things from a sacred standpoint. And then there are other religions that women shouldn't even be seen. You can certainly move from point A to point B, but you better cover up from head to toe. And I just... And you made the interesting comment about, you know, for men, it's a power grab. My first thought when I started when I started pursuing this particular interview with you, my first thought was that men are so fearful. I mean, that was the only thing that I could come away with of women, that they have to play this stupid game of subjugation, of enslaving and so forth. As a matter of fact, I just saw the movie Suffragette. And I thought, so women are that powerful that you've got to keep them down? Really? Yeah. Then you better take another look at how much power they have, because if they're that powerful that you have to do this, then that ain't going to work.
Right. Well, let me say something about the Garden of Eden. I mean, you've said so much there. Let me make a couple comments. The first thing, the Garden of Eden myth. When we're going back and rethinking these myths and retelling these myths, because it is so important that we reawaken them and reinterpret them and maybe even retell them with a different slant. Think about, you know, why did we even have a God in that story that was going to condemn us because we wanted to eat from the tree of knowledge? Mm. That's a problem right there, okay? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Irregardless of, you know, who did what and who got the blame, you know, if I were going to write the myth, you know, it would have been more about, you know, allowing humanity to have knowledge so that they could be the best that they could be. Why punish them for curiosity, for seeking knowledge to better themselves? Okay, that's one thing. The Hindus, you know, the Hindus with their goddesses, yes, we can say that the Hindus have at least not swept their goddesses beneath the rug. But you have to look to that in many cases, with the exception of maybe Kali, the warrior goddess, the Hindus, their goddesses are a shadow of their former selves. Some scholars say they've been domesticated, they've been spousified. Not 100%, but in a lot of cases, they're not a whole lot more than the god's wife. You know, they're his consort, they're not really equal, you know.
Almost, maybe another word, concubine, would that be an appropriate?
Well, that might be going a little too far.
Okay.
You know, that might be going a little too far, but they're certainly not the equal, you know. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think, you know, those things are important. And then I'm trying to remember, what was your final point about, women being so powerful? And why are men so afraid? Honestly, I think it's about sexuality, and that's why sexuality has become such a taboo subject in patriarchy. When you think about how profound a wonderful sexual experience can be, you know, when it used to be thought that it was through sexuality, through intercourse, that the divine, you know, that you could actually, you know, interact with the divine, you could have communion with God. Okay, mm-hmm. That's a powerful thing. That really renders rabbis and priests and holy people irrelevant, doesn't it? If together through sexual union you could experience the divine. You know, you think about women and their sacred blood. There was a time when it was coveted. It was thought to give immortality, or it had magical powers. So if you really think that, then you certainly want to subjugate the person who creates that, don't you? Mm-hmm. You know, now I realize that we know better now, you know, but we for a time there, we didn't understand the man's role in procreation. So if you're someone from these early days and it's woman who is the life giver, and you don't like the fact that she's revered because she's the life giver, she can bleed without dying, you better come up with a reason to subjugate her, to suppress her power, to demonize her if you want to compete or maybe, be more powerful than her.
You know, I told myself as I was growing up that I was not going to buy into the marketing campaigns, if you will, the propaganda, if you will, of the advertising industry, because, you know, I knew what they were selling and I wanted none of it, if you will. But, you know, I'm just like, you know, everybody else. And I did. And so there are times when I find myself slipping, if you will, into those kinds of things. You know, I'm on my second marriage, but I have learned with my second wife especially, but I did with my first, how important and valuable the information, the insight, the intuition, probably the best word of all, that they have to offer if but I would listen. And I've had situations where, you know, I felt as though, well, wait a minute, where's my opportunity to make my own choice? Why do I have to listen to you and follow your intuition? Why shouldn't I just listen to my own that may be different? And yeah, I may make mistakes, but why can't you just let me do that? Counter that with, why can't I just listen to your intuition so I don't make these mistakes? And I know there's an ego thing going on.
Well, you know, Richard, I think you've hit on something important, because really what those of us like me and the sacred feminine movement are saying moving forward, it's not just about elevating men. We have sort of evolved, I mean, elevating women. You know, we have evolved, I think, from the first feminist who were out there just trying to pave a way for women because there was none. I think, you know, us now, many of us, or talking about partnership. It's about figuring out how we can be partners for each other. And you just said it beautifully. It's about you listening to her and her listening to him. And we, because together we are so much more powerful. We complement each other. And but that hasn't been the way it's been, you know. And I think if your listeners go away with remembering nothing else that I've said today, let it be this idea that we have to seek and find equality and partnership, because then you're listening to her intuition and she's listening to your. I don't have a problem saying men have intuition too. I mean, I think they do. I'm here in California because of my husband's intuition. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the one that said, Karen, you know, this is what I really think we have to do. And in the moment, you know, I had my doubts and it was a little scary when we left Louisiana to come to California, but I trusted him and I followed his intuition and it was the best move we ever made. And likewise, he gives me that same consideration. So it is all about partnership. In fact, you know, Rhian Eisler, who was my mentor, she first started talking about partnership at the back of her book, the very famous book called Chalice and the Blade, which really sort of put me on this path. You learn in the front of the book about herstory and everything that's been swept beneath the rug by patriarchy, and it moves into, okay, our solution. This is what's happened. Yeah, it's been lousy, but the solution is partnership. And now she teaches about, and I teach about, and you know, a lot of her Pied Pipers like myself, we talk about partnership, partnership with ourself, partnership with our intimate others, partnership on a local and global scale, partnership with deity and the source. Because if we need partnership in all those different areas in order for us to be healthy humans, for us to create a healthy world.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And yet, because we haven't had the practice over the course of the generations of doing that, it is a bit of a struggle for both sides, because on the one hand, you've got the man who said, you know, I want to be in control. I'm the man and blah, 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 the old stereotype. And you have the woman saying, well, I would really like to participate. I'll give you a couple of quick examples here that I think are rather profound. My second wife, she was going through a very serious condition. She was going through cancer and chemo and so forth. And a dear friend of ours who lived with us for a period of time, he was helping us to build this greenhouse that she wanted. She really wanted this greenhouse. It was one of her dreams. So we went out and she was able to purchase, but we said we would build for her. And one evening we were out there and he and I, we were chatting about, okay, well, this is where this is and this is how this goes. But, you know, I don't know if that's what she wants. So we went into the house and we went to her and we said, we need you to come outside. We need you to show you something because we need your advice on something. And it actually moved her to tears because she said, nobody's ever asked for my advice like this. And we said, well, it was only logical for us because, well, it's your greenhouse. It's not ours. And we're building it for you, yes. But, you know, we want to make sure that it's the way that you want it. And so I think that from that standpoint, you know, we went a long way in sort of, I don't know if the word is cementing or fomenting, the relationship the three of us had, because we were like a family. We were very close. And it was really very, you know, very cool. But I think that kind of cooperation, if you will, and drawing each other in, this is a little difficult for a lot of folks.
Well, it's because, you know, we haven't been doing it, you know. I mean, you guys are ahead of the game. You know, some men still would not think of asking a woman's opinion, and some women still would not think of offering it. And I think that's a very good and important point, because women need practice at offering their opinion too. You know, I mean, so many women are still stuck in that little patriarchal box. I mean, I know coming from the South, you know, it was, you know, I mean, we were taught that it was only men's opinions that mattered. You know, the woman's domain was the house. Now, granted, things are changing, but in a lot of places, it's still that way. Women's opinions just don't matter. And, you know, those types of women are still being raised and they're still out there in society with the men who have to have this consummate control. But let's think about it. You know, when you need to have that consummate control and power over, you know, when you sift to the bottom of that, that reveals a lot of fear, you know. You know, there's a lot of fear there, or maybe a lot of entitlement too. And that's, you know, that's going to have to be worked through because it is, you know, all about negotiation and partnership and collaboration. That's the new world we're all, you know, trying to create together. And some people are going to evolve and some people aren't. Maybe we have to wait for some people to die out.
Well,
but I think that's why the younger generation, the millennials, don't have a problem with democratic socialism, you know, because it is about this idea of we're all in this together. You know, it doesn't occur to them that women aren't equal or that, you know, we should be prejudiced against brown skin people. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they are going to be the new generation that is really going to push these better ideas forward, and you know, maybe this be the norm rather than the fringe ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to agree in that respect, and I certainly would hope so. And of course, that's what we do on this program: is we look for those new ways of living that work because the old ones aren't. And I mean, that's pretty self-evident. You know, if people would just open their eyes, and we have a lifeboat that'll hold 7.5 billion people. It's not a problem here. One condition, though, only one condition for you to get on the lifeboat. You have to be willing to let go of the old ways of doing things.
Yeah. Well, and you
know, that's hard.
It's interesting, too. I mean, as a, you know, they say sometimes our astrological sign says something about ourselves. And mm-hmm. In the case of myself, I'm a Virgo, so I like logic. And, you know, I at one point, you know, I had to figure out, okay, so why are people, you know, why are we so polarized now?
Yeah.
And there's studies out there that actually talk about the amygdala of our brain is different whether you're a conservative or you're a liberal. A liberal is more willing to take risk and try new things. A conservative, not so much. That's why conservatives tend to support authority, even if the authority is oppressive. And that's what we see. You know, we see, for instance, let's just take as a broad generalization what happened, you know, what happens with the shootings out there, you mm-hmm. know, the shootings that we keep having. Well, you have some people that say, oh, this is an outrage. You know, we have to, you know, stop allowing the police to be so militarized. They need better training. And then you have people who say, they're the police. They're there to protect us. You know, they're just, you know, doing what they have to do to protect themselves. So you can see the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who, you know, who will prop up authority, even when authority, you know, sort of gets out of whack. I think a perfect example of that is capitalism. You know, we are living under, you know, dominator capitalism that is oppressing so many people. But yet you hear people say, oh, well, the corporations are the job creators. You know, they don't even think about the fact that trickle-down economics has been proven not to work. They go with what they're familiar with, even if it's killing people because they are afraid to try something new.
Yeah. Well, I had come up with a new ism, if you will, that we needed to try to adopt because the old isms didn't work. And the new ism that I came up with, which is, it's kind of cumbersome, but it was the only thing I could think of because And this was the analogy that I used. I said, consider your cell, the cells of your body. What is them? Okay? What, and I guess I can use the term, what form of government, if you will, do your cells operate under? Is it democracy? Well, of course not. Because if each cell had its own voice and decided its own way of going, then your body would basically self-destruct. It would fall apart. Okay? Now, under communism, you'd have a central control. Well, some would say, well, that's the brain, but the brain's made up of cells too, so we're not talking about that. In other words, and you go on and on in that regard. So I thought, well, okay, people hate to hear the word socialism or communism being espoused or promoted in any way, shape, or there's something wrong with that ism, those isms, and so we can't go that way. And I thought, okay, well, what about this one? And I heard about this throughout the 90s and the first part of the 21st century, that we are all connected and we affect one another. So what better term than interdependentism as a form, as an ism to, so to speak, foster? Your thoughts on that before we go to break?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, you know, the sacred feminine has always been about our interconnection. Interdependentism, because we are all dependent on one another. You know, even the CEO who's making, $600,000 a year while he pays his employees so little they have to be on food stamps, that's corporate welfare, corporate socialism. You know, they are dependent on one another. He needs those workers. The workers need him. So why not, come to a middle ground where we realize that and have some cooperation, don't have domination, because we can be interdependent, but is it a healthy interdependence, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because what I just described is interdependence, but it's still a dominator form of it. So we really have to get to a healthy interdependence, because the interdependence can still be oppression.
I can certainly understand that. I certainly can. And it's in an effort, more than anything else, to find some new way of doing things, of saying, look, these other forms have inherent drawbacks. I want to use the word hazard, but they have inherent drawbacks.
Right.
That show us that in the long term, they don't work, and they never evolved in a way that was beneficial for all. And that's really what we're talking about, is something that is beneficial for everyone and not just a select few. I honestly have to say that I don't want to exclude anybody from the process. Everybody should have the opportunity. That's why, by the way, there is one socialist organization here in the United States that is allowed to be such, because if it weren't, it wouldn't survive. And that's the military. You cannot go into the military and call your own shots and go your own way and expect to have any chance of any kind of victory, if that's, if that's what you're going there for. I mean, that's the way they train you. You follow orders.
Yeah.
But even that whole system is being challenged because of, certainly some of the orders that are being given. We are talking with Dr. Karen Tate, and we're going to continue our conversation with her in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Her website is karentate.com, karentate.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. We are talking with Reverend Dr. Karen Tate. Karen, you have, I'm getting familiar here, but you have a background that, on the one hand, I envy in the sense that you have not only been all over the globe and you've studied so many different things, so many different areas, especially, I'm going to use the term comparative religions in that regard, to feminism, and you've been a part of so much that it's just, first of all, it's wonderful to have the opportunity to talk with you as well as to have you expound on a lot of these different points. And I'm just curious, I mean, I know you mentioned a particular primer that sort of started you on this path, but where were you before you stepped for the first time on this particular path and said, yep, this is the way I'm going?
Well, you know, in a way, I guess you could say nobody's more surprised than me. I am where I'm at because I started in New Orleans in the Bible Belt, a Catholic. And I have to say, though, it never really sunk its hooks in me. You know, I went to Catholic school for the first few years. And, you know, I have to say the guy on the cross at the front of the church, I never really bought into all the sacrifice and suffering. You know, mm-hmm. I was sort of born into it, but it never became a real part of my life. I was actually more interested even back then in different cultures and comparative religions. I often joked with my family that I asked if the milkman left me on the porch because, you know, I didn't really feel like I fit in with most of the people I knew, you know, because I would question authority and other people, it didn't occur to them to question authority. And, you know, that made for some, you know, for some interesting conversations. But, you know, after a while, when nobody around you was questioning and you're the only one questioning, you kind of stop questioning. And I think I did for a while. You know, I got tired of being the odd man out and I just sort of kept my questions to myself. But, you know, my husband and I, we ended up moving to California. And I like to say that, you know, the great she, the divine feminine, was sort of just waiting for me to wake up because I attended a class about the feminine face of God. And it was a slippery slope from there on out because, you know, at first it's about discovering that you were never intended to be a second class citizen, you know, and, you know, it's about that personal empowerment. And then when you realize how the values can make the world a better place, well, I mean, that's how it led for me to social justice activism and learning how important it is that we all take responsibility for our own education because, you know, there are so many agendas out there. Oh, I mean, yeah. We read now about the Koch brothers who are having influence on colleges because they donate so much money that, you know, they are making sure, you know, conservative professors are being placed in these, you know, colleges promoting their version of economics, you know. Mm. So it's really dangerous out there when we don't have balance. And, you know, going back to your idea about, you know, interdependence or interconnection, mm-hmm. balance is maybe, you know, somehow I think that's really the most important because, you know, we need liberal views so that we aren't stuck doing the same thing over and over again, even when it doesn't work. But we also need, I think, some conservative ideas. We need to complement one another, you know, we need to get back to the point where we have a healthy, well, I mean, I don't know if we ever did, but we have to get to a point where I think we have a healthy respect for both sides, listen to both sides, find common ground. And, you know, I think maybe liberals have to have a respect for being conservative and conservatives have to get out of that box of conformity and fear and let us move forward and not keep trying to pull us back, you know, into the 19th or 20th century.
I couldn't agree with you more in that respect. I think that one of the things I said this to a programmer many years ago, a conservative host of a program. And, you know, I said, it's not that I agree or disagree with your perspective, but you know, you rail against the liberals and the Democrats and the, you know, and you make all kinds of derogatory comments toward them. And could I present this particular perspective to you? Because, see, I have worked for both liberal and conservative talk programs, radio, news and information stations. And I've come to the point where I have no use for any of them because, you know, they do not acknowledge what the point I'm about to make. I said to this gentleman, I said, do you ever consider the possibility that you're partially responsible for the things you're blaming them for that are the ills of our society because you let it happen? Because you didn't gather your forces together and make sure that you had a larger voting block or whatever, you know, whatever the case might be. And the converse is just as true. And it's right. Like you owe them your talk show. You owe them the fact that you have the opportunity to sit here, moan and groan and complain. And he even wrote a book labeling liberals as having a disease. A brain disease, and but this is where I kind of have this whole problem. Whether it's left and right, whether it's male, female, up, down, and so on and so forth, it's like we're not getting anywhere. I ask the question of people, and I even put this to you: do you really think that the common man, and I would put you and I in that category, is better off today than they were 60 years ago? And my assessment, I don't know what yours is, but mine is no.
Well, you know, I think it depends on who you are, you know. So let me answer it two ways. First of all, I think probably at the heart of a lot of this is lack of education. And I think when you think about how education is sort of going down the tubes and how little people know. I mean, I'm sure you've seen Jay Leno when he had his show, you know, out in the street asking every man, you know, who's the vice president or who's buried in Grant's tomb.
Mm-hmm.
It's startling how little people know.
Mm-hmm.
That scares the heck out of me. I wonder how many conservatives know how much liberalism has brought to their life, how much socialism is actually in the United States. So you see, I think because they don't really know, they're easily manipulated by the mainstream media who, you know, they just feed bread and circuses. Or we've seen in this presidential campaign how bad off journalism is. I mean, it used to be the fourth estate. It used to be the fourth house of government, so to speak, that was supposed to be out there protecting democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've changed the laws. They are unfettered now, so they can they have no regulation to speak the truth. So we end up with Fox News, who perpetuates ideas that keep us divided. And, you know, but going to your point, you're absolutely right. Don't you have some responsibility for the monster you created?
Mm-hmm. They're even saying that of the Republicans. It's like, you're upset with Trump. You created him.
Exactly. So, you know, maybe more people are starting to get this, you know, that it was fun for a while for conservatives when they were dominating the airwaves, when they, had all of these, you know, people with distorted views of reality that followed Fox News. But now they see the result of that, you know. But were we better, you know, 60 years ago? I don't know. Women were worse off.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly if you were a black person, you were worse off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when people say, give me the 50s again. Well, were the 50s really that good unless you were maybe a white guy?
Well, it even goes, you take that analogy or that logic, if you will, and say, well, if that's where you want to go, then you have to take all of the 50s, just like those who want to blast individuals who are in same-sex relationships and they use Old Testament law. It's like, well, wait a minute, hold on. There are 613 laws of which that is one. You cannot take one without taking them all. Are you prepared to do that?
Right.
You know? Right. So, and I agree with you. The whole aspect of education, for me, is it's critical. It is absolutely the most critical aspect of any human being's existence, to have the right to explore and to consider, not to be programmed and propagandized at, if you will. And that's one of the things that I think I give my parents so much credit for, as well as their respect. I don't see them as my parents anymore. I see them as just, they're just friends. They're very good friends, and we have great conversations and so forth. But education is, it's like, I kind of rail on this one, and that is that if you don't have the remedial skills to enter college, guess what? You need to go back. You do not get to move forward. We will not put remedial courses in the universities and post-secondary institutions, because that's not where you're supposed to get that stuff. You were supposed to get that in grade school and high school. So guess what? Back you go. And then the system has to teach you how to read and write and think critically and so forth. That's where that, and that's just my opinion, mind you. But it seems to me that higher education is just that. How high can you go? What do you want to pursue? You want to be a nuclear physicist? Wonderful. You want to be a philosopher? You want to be an art major? You want to go into politics? You want to be an engineer, an architect, etc., on infinitum? But you can't do that if you don't have the basics, and you're supposed to get that early in your life.
Well, look, I agree with you, and I'm not an educator. You know, there are probably, teachers who could speak better to this. You know, I can just say from an, anecdotal perspective that, education is, I think, failing everyone. And again, maybe this is going to sound conspiratorial, but, you know, when you think about it, if the masses are uneducated, if the masses are fearful, then they are more easily manipulated. And I, when you think about, what's the first thing cut? You know, the arts, mm-hmm. And those are important things. You look at how kids are taught in Scandinavia. It's a whole different sort of educational system. And, it seems like, maybe they grow a more well-rounded, better educated person in some of these other countries. And I think to a certain extent it is intended. And I know how that probably sounds to some people, and I hate to even, publicly utter those words, but I think the powers that be want to keep us afraid and, want to keep us divided, and they're doing a great job of it. So yeah. Education, somehow we have to get back on track. And educate people so that facts matter. I mean, when did it start? It seems like to me with Sarah Palin, and it might have been before then, but it seemed like when Sarah Palin hit the stage, or maybe that's just when I first noticed it, but people were wearing ignorance as a badge of honor.
Yeah.
And how much can we lay, how much of this can we lay at the feet of religion, I think to a certain extent, religion it keeps people dumbed down a bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just think we have to have the courage to rethink an awful lot, because it's these bastions of authority that have created the world we live in, with their rhetoric, with their ideology, with their mythology. And we have to have the courage to think about what a new world would look like, because until we can vision it, until we can imagine it, then we'll never manifest it.
I couldn't agree more. Well, obviously, you've had a more than a sufficient education to garner a large number of books that you have authored: Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology. There's a mouthful for you. Sacred Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. Walking an Ancient Path, a Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, and Voice of the Sacred Feminine, Conversations to Reshape Our World, which is also part of what you your radio program is all about as well. And I'm curious as to these works and any others that you have also put into print, even articles for that matter. Where do you find your inspiration in that regards? What is it that triggers you saying, I got to write about this? I got to put this down before I forget it.
Well, it's just sometimes it can be a headline. Sometimes it's what's happening out there in the world. You know, sometimes it's, the latest course I'm taking. I mean, for instance, I just recently took one of Rhianne Eisler's webinars, from the Center of Partnership Studies, and it was on different forms of domination. And so that we can recognize it when we see it. And the thing that I focused on was how our corporate-owned media is a form of domination because of their bias, because of their failure, in journalism. You know, they're no longer the fourth estate. You just never know. Different ways, and if it makes my hair on fire, that's something I'm probably going to look into and write about or invite a guest on my show. I have to say, my show is my guilty pleasure because I don't have the time to read all the books I want to learn. I invite people on my show and I ask them questions, and that's my continuing education in some areas as well.
Now, I it's mine as well, but it's also my therapy. I've been saying that for decades. I get free therapeutic advice on the program from the questions that I ask. I have a friend who has this issue, and it's great fun. I also view it as it's almost like Christmas and opening up a package, a present, and inside it is, in this case, your world. And I get to not only experience a little bit of it, I get to hear about it. I get to hear about some of your ideas and say, that sounds interesting. I may incorporate that into my life. And I am obviously forever changed in that regard. And hopefully it is a two-way street as well. And that's kind of how I look at doing these kinds of programs, because hopefully I'm interested, I'm inspired and educated, and I'm hoping that our listeners are as well by the information that is available here through this program, but also through your website, which is KarenTate.com. And we encourage people to go to that website, KarenTate.com.
And
I beg your pardon. Starting with a K. Beg your pardon. Karen with a K. And go to that website and check it out and find out what she has to offer. There's, I happen to only see the trailer of the film, Femme, Women Healing the World. I'm looking forward to, I may very well go ahead and pick this up myself and watch it, because of some of the women who are in it, including yourself. We've even had one in particular, Barbara Marx Hubbard, on the program talking about the evolution of, and I use the term man in a very broad sense, as many do, but of our species, maybe that's a better way to put it, and wondering where in the heck we're going to be in 20 years or 40 years or 60, both as a civilization, but, as a people. What are we going to evolve into from here? And granted, I've only been around for 56 years, and I haven't seen a whole lot of change, but I've been curious. I've been asking questions, as you. I'm curious what your observations are. Where do you think we're going to be in 50 or 100 years? Same places? We're still going to be grappling over the same old stuff? Or will the higher consciousness kick in and we will evolve forward and upward and onward beyond a lot of this minutia?
Well, you know, I believe maybe a decade down the road, we're going to see some significant change, because I think we're seeing it already. I mean, it feels like two steps forward, one step back sometimes. But I think even this ugliness that we're seeing out there in this political sphere right now is serving a good purpose. I think it's showing us. People don't change until they have to change, you know. But I think people are seeing just how bad it is, and I think, you know, there are different players out there who are catalysts for the good and for the bad. I mean, I look at Bernie Sanders, and I think, you know, he is one of the people that is pushing this paradigm shift, to a more loving and caring society, while Donald Trump, in a way, is doing the same thing, because he's saying, you know, what he is showing us is exactly what we don't want to be. You know, so there's even a gift, I think, in the challenges. There's even a gift in the bad things that come along if we look for it. You know, I've had some interesting guests, you know, who have talked about, technology. And as technology advances, the bad side is that fewer and fewer jobs will be out there. However, the solution to that is people could potentially be given a stipend to live on. And, you know, as long as their basic needs are met, then they will have time to pursue the things that that they care about, to pursue their passions. I think that's a real interesting idea, because I would go for that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And it's going to be a challenge, to say the very least, wherever we're headed next, regardless. And I think that we need to stay open to the possibilities, the myriad possibilities that are out there, because I think that's one of the things that holds us back. We don't think certain things are even possible. And I hate to, use an old, for me anyway, it's an old cliche. Look, we didn't think we could send a man to the moon, and look what happened. We've done so many other great things. And that's one of the sad things for me is, Karen, is that, I look back on my lifetime, and the last thing I can ever remember that the planet as a whole actually rallied around was the space program, where, we were concerned for the health, welfare, and the safety of the astronauts coming home safely. And we were glued to the television set, in terms of what was happening. And we wanted to make sure that everything was okay and so forth. And the whole planet was watching and hoping that, like, for example, Apollo 13 and that whole thing. And that's the last time I can recall that we ever collectively shared that kind of a dream.
Yeah. Well, and it's been said, and I know this is cliche too, but I tend to agree, what will it take, an alien invasion, for us to have global unity? I don't know. I think there are a lot more people being educated today in spite of the problems we see. I think power ebbs and flows. Maybe one day the United States will not be the influence it once was, and maybe that's a good thing, because should the country should the country lead just because they have the most bombs and bullets? I have hope. I have hope that humanity will get its collective shit together, if you will, because we'll have to. I honestly think it's global warming that may be the thing that will bring us together in the future. It will be our very survival. And in this huge challenge, in this life or death challenge, I think we have the potential to come together, and it will be the thing that will I think, cause the unity and cause the solidarity. You know, that may be the gift in, you know, the horrible thing that that we're faced with.
And I know your intent, of course, is not to drive any kind of a wedge between the sexes, but I'm curious as to your observations on the goddess spirituality versus, say, the god spirituality, which, of course, is, you know, patriarchally based, if you will. You know, and is there really a big difference, or is it more a matter of, hey, it's the way we see things, and we can see things in a lot of different ways if we'll just open our eyes to kind of sort of merge the two? They'll become sort of one someday, or we will say, you know, we don't need these anymore.
Well, you know, I think spirituality is really about morality. And I think an atheist, you know, can be a moral person. I think whatever gets you there is what's important. You know, that's why I think budgets, you know, government budgets are really about morality too. I mean, I mentioned Jesus earlier in the show, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think the things he taught, you know, go hand in glove with goddess spirituality. The only problem with Jesus is, you know, the fact that he's part of this patriarchal religion that marginalized women. So, you know, I like to say, I imagine the sacred feminine and the divine masculine, whether you think of them as a deity, an archetype, a metaphor, values, you know, I like to think of them as sitting in their rocking chairs together, scratching their head, saying, why did our children divorce us? You know, we're here together. You know, we didn't leave each other. You know, why did they separate us? And, you know, I think we need to marry the good attributes of the feminine and the masculine together in ourselves, in our societies, in our governments. And, you know, that's the answer. It's partnership. Again, it keeps going back to partnership.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that one of the things that is so fascinating for me is something that one of our guests, Greg Braden, had to say in that regard, and that and even science has borne this out, that cooperation is much more productive. The quality of the work is so much better than it is competition.
Yes. Well, and you see, capitalism is all about competition, you know, but where the sacred feminine or, you know, is more about, some have called it game theory. I think in game theory, gamers will understand, it's about creating win-win situations. Mm-hmm. It's not about competition and from the sense that there's winners and losers. I mean, imagine if you, you know, if you went into negotiations with the idea, I am not going to kill the opponent and dominate the opponent, but we are going to both come out of this with something we need. You know,
yeah.
It's in the mindset, you know, and if we're taught, I think, you know, to go in with the mindset that negotiation is a good thing, compromise is a good thing, partnership is a good thing, those are the goals, rather than we have to rule, we have to dominate, we have to have power over, you know, then, you know, we have to start teaching our children better. We have to start acting differently. You know, we have to set the bar higher and not tolerate these, the dominator society that we live in. You know, we have to do better.
Yeah. Well, I know that for me, and the fact that I got into this business almost 40 years ago, to me, it was about doing that, helping to raise the bar. And some days it's harder than others. And I have a couple of little pet peeves when it comes to that, and that is the issue of grammar. This goes back to our conversation about education. When giving out phone numbers in the media, there are no zeros in telephone numbers, people. And when you are addressing someone on radio or television, you always speak in the first person. You don't address yourself, hi, this is, I am. If I was introducing you to somebody, Karen, I would say, oh, so-and-so, this is Karen Tate. Dr. Reverend Karen Tate. That's when you'd use "this is," but not when you're identifying yourself. Now, is it the norm? Sure. But that's only because people choose to continue to do that. And I learned in grade school that aspect of grammar. Now, were they wrong? Well, I hope not. I hope they weren't. I even sent my my book that I'm getting close to publishing off to my sister to proof for me, because she has the background to do that. When it came back, she had commas after she had ands where my commas were and the comma. And I thought, wait a minute, that's not right. And then I did some research and I found out that either and or both are still grammatically correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I found out things change, mm-hmm. too, you know, and now you're making me think I'm going to have to go back and listen to my own shows and see if I say I am or this is. but look, you know, I think things in grammar do change, you know, when you have colloquialisms. And mm-hmm. I know when I first wrote my Goddess book, for instance, it was a big issue with the publisher that the publisher didn't want me to capitalize Goddess. And I said, you know what, I can't do this book if you don't let me capitalize Goddess, because the whole point of this is saying Goddess is equal to God. You wouldn't think of putting God in lowercase, would you? And it was really interesting because he put it to a poll on an editor web base. And he says, okay, editors out there, what do you think? Should I let her capitalize Goddess? And, you know, it was so funny. The answers all came back along gender lines. The women editors said, yes, absolutely, she should capitalize Goddess. And the guy said, no, no.
Oh, wow.
You know, but it's funny. You know, I'm saying that as kind of a joke.
Sure.
But, you know, but just to say that you're absolutely right. Grammar is important. But, you know, things change.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole new world out there in how we communicate. I mean, just look at the people who, I mean, that's one of my pet peeves. You know, how can we have partnership if we don't have better communication skills? And that's one of the things I worry about with social media and the internet. I think we are creating people who don't have good social skills anymore.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to be the kind of guy who says, the kids' music back then was just terrible. You know, I remember hearing those kinds of phrases when I was growing up, and I wasn't even listening to that music, but still, you'd hear those comments. I go, I do not want to be an adult and make those kinds of comments. Now, the music of today is so eclectic, it's so wide and varied, that sometimes you're not even exposed to some of the stuff that could potentially be objectionable to some folks in the older generation. I may not understand it. That's irrelevant. It still has some value in that respect to the folks who are listening to it. Whether it's culturally beneficial, that's maybe more for history to decide. But I think you're right. And I think we also need to, you know, cut folks some slack sometimes as well and help to try to educate them. And again, as you say, we need to work on collaboration and cooperation in that regard to get to that point. And maybe then we can go to the higher ground, as it were, and have a much better society and social structure and on and on and on and you know, get somewhere. I would love for us to, as a species, as a society, to take on some new projects, you know?
Well, you know, I would love that too, but I think first we have to, you know, figure out how to take care of our own people. You know, I get annoyed that we never have anybody out there saying, you know, saying to us, well, what about your quality of life? Instead, you know, we only hear about tax cuts for the rich, that the industrial complex isn't big enough, all the while, you know, seniors haven't had a raise in Social Security, soldiers aren't getting their VA benefits, you know what I mean, infrastructure is crumbling. You know, I would like to see what Bernie Sanders suggested, is that, you know, we need, you know, like Fox News came out to perpetuate the ideas they wanted to put out in the world. I'd like to see a station that could talk about the things we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
you know, talk, you know, educate people on the social issues so that they could make a more informed decision, you know?
Yeah, and to that point, I've actually considered this as a format for a station if I were to purchase one, and it would have a rather eclectic source of news affiliations that would not just be domestic, but would also be foreign and in English, that people could get different perspectives. I mean, I happen to listen to Sky News out of the UK as well as the BBC. How many people in this country even know what's going on in Africa and in the Middle East and in China and in Eastern Europe, let alone in the UK or in the EU and so forth? And some people don't even want to know. And it's like, but they are part of our community, too. And we need to know what's going on. And I mean, when this whole thing came across with the what they call the Brexit, and then they voted, and then I started hearing all of this Texit, and Texas was going to leave the union. And I'm going, okay, bye. if that's what you want to do, but are you really, have you really thought this through? Have you really done the research? No, they're on a bandwagon of whatever it is they're on, and they don't. And this is, again, part of the issue. So I would love to be able to provide that kind of forum, as well as programs like yours and mine and others who are trying to put out a wide and varied informational source, if you will. Honestly, this program, I don't have questions. I mean, I don't have them formulated per se, even in my head. The universe asks the questions. I'm just along for the ride. I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth sometimes. But I try to be tactful, respectful, grammatically correct if I can, and articulate, or at least have the diction to speak what needs to be said, and then let the listener decide. We put out a smorgasbord, and you come to the table, and you take what you want. But if you can't see it, if it's not distinguishable, if the message is muddled up even in the audio quality, how can you make a decision, really? And if it's a soundbite, if I just had you on, Karen, for 2 minutes, how much would we really be able to accomplish?
Yeah. But, so easily to misunderstand each other.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I would like to thank you so much for sharing this hour with us. This has been fantastic.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much. I think we are trying to inspire. You know, we are trying to give people permission to think outside the box. That's really what it's going to take. So thank you for your show too, Richard.
Well, thank you. And if you should find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, even though you're in California, we'd love to have you in studio to continue our conversation. And then I have three final questions for you as we wrap up our program. And again, many thanks for joining us. The first is, who is Karen Tate?
Who is Karen Tate? Karen Tate, social justice activist, emissary priestess of the sacred feminine.
I like that. I like that. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I would like to plant the seeds for a better tomorrow and make the world a better place.
And what is your life's purpose?
I think to be the voice for feminine ideals, to help change the world.
Again, I thank you so much for sharing with us yourself, your time and energy here on the program. And we do look forward to having you back on the program in the near future.
Thank you so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. My guest again, Reverend Dr. Karen Tate, and her website, karentate.com. Check it out. She has a number of books I think you'd really enjoy, plus the film that we were talking about, Femme, Women Healing the World. Until next time, as we give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true, we say, love to Lal.